The saying is sure, whoever aspires to the office of bishop desires a noble task. Now a bishop must be above reproach, married only once, temperate, sensible, respectable, hospitable, an apt teacher, not a drunkard, not violent, but gentle, not quarrelsome, and not a lover of money. He must manage his own household well, keeping his children submissive and respectful in every way. For if someone does not know how to manage his own household, how can he take care of God's church? He must not be a recent convert, or he may be puffed up with conceit and fall into the condemnation of the devil. Moreover, he must be well thought of by outsiders, so that he may not fall into disgrace and the snare of the devil. Deacons, likewise, must be serious, not double-tongued, not indulging in much wine, not greedy for money. They must hold fast to the mystery of the faith with a clear conscience, and let them first be tested. Then, if they prove themselves blameless, let them serve as deacons. Women, likewise, must be serious, not slanderers, but temperate, faithful in all things. Let deacons be married only once, and let them manage their children and their households well. For those who serve well as deacons gain a good standing for themselves and great boldness in the faith that is in Christ Jesus. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
The topic today is leadership. What kind of leaders should we have? Imagine this issue comes up here and there. You might be thinking about this in other places and other platforms. But Paul is talking about leadership in the church. Now, this apostle must have been pretty old at the time he mentions all of this, because church offices took a while to develop and become widespread. Bishops or overseers or deacons, and then later in the letter, elders, particularly elders that preach. It took a while for all that to develop and become an organization with some kind of hierarchy. That took a while, so we think this letter probably came late in the writing of the New Testament. Now, in our Presbyterian preliminary principles in our Book of Order, we believe that... Well, hello there. I'll keep talking and maybe the sound will carry. We believe that any association of Christian people can decide how to organize themselves, that church organization is not a one-size-fits-all. The people who are governed can decide how they're going to be governed. Years ago, I was reminded of this when our presbytery asked me to moderate a small church, a church nearby. We opened the meeting in prayer, we approved the minutes, and then I asked for a report from the Christian Education Committee. They looked at one another and began to chuckle. The elders around the table then started to laugh. "We only have 35 members," they said. "We don't have any committees." Sure enough, they made all their decisions in the parking lot, it seems, and I, as the visiting moderator, was there to rubber stamp whatever they had already decided. In some churches, that's how it is. Likewise, we Presbyterians have never thought very much about bishops. Paul and Timothy may have had them in their churches, but we don't and we haven't. Bishops can be trouble. Bishops move around your preachers by the time that they're getting to learn everybody's name. Bishops tell others what to do, a top-down model. And Presbyterians have always been a little resistant to that. We make decisions as a group. Issues are decided on the floor, and then maybe they get bumped upstairs for wider discussion. So to hear Paul talk about bishops doesn't sound all that interesting. Bishops. Do you really care about bishops? Well, maybe. Paul says, if you're a bishop, you should not be a drunkard. Likewise, the deacons should not indulge in too much wine. Now, what do you suppose the deacons' meetings were actually like back then? Why would he have to say this? Or the repeated warning that neither bishop nor deacon should be greedy, that church leaders should not be in love with money. Yeah, I can see you looking at me. Now, do you think that's a problem? Well, you tell me. How about Joel Osteen, that television evangelist with the big multiple thousand member church? Does he really need a 17,000 square foot tax-free mansion with three elevators? Or how about the recent financial reports that have come out of Liberty University and its president, Jerry Falwell Jr.? It seems recently the church has been buying up a lot of real estate, enormous amount of real estate, not for classrooms or dormitories, but just to invest in real estate. And it's taking the money from tuition funds it has received from its students. Not only that, the Baptist has been photographed in Florida dance clubs where alcohol is served. Say it isn't so. The topic today is leadership. Christian leadership in the Christian church. What kind of leaders do we need? Okay, I'll just keep talking. Paul has his list of character traits: temperate, sensible, respectable, hospitable, gentle, not quarrelsome, and above reproach. And then he says, married only once, which is a line that has provoked a lot of divorced leaders to flinch, especially if they had their hearts really set on serving as a bishop in one of Paul's churches. It's also a line that has kept at least one single person from serving as a deacon. As she said to me, how can I serve as a deacon if I've never even been married once? Good point. The sense of the text is that in the old King James translation that declares that bishops and deacons should be married to one wife, which makes it a bit clearer. The rule is about fidelity and faithfulness. If you're not faithful at home, how can you be faithful with the people you serve? If your home life is not well ordered, you'll almost certainly make a mess of the church or the organization you're serving. This is important. One of the most painful conversations I ever have had was on the front porch of a conference center one summer. A man from Fort Lauderdale told me why he left his congregation and would never go back. His pastor was a good friend, very prominent preacher. He was well-spoken, well-loved, and very well-paid. And then the voicemail recording surfaced, and the text messages were posted anonymously on a website. It seems he had a string of lady friends in addition to his third wife. All the women suddenly found out about one another, and when the church authorities confronted him, he immediately quit the ministry to avoid responsibility, and then he blamed the authorities for what he had done. There was a lot of hush money, confidentiality agreements, but everybody knew what happened, and the elder said to me, I'm never going back to church ever again. In a recent New York Times article titled, Why People Hate Religion, Timothy Egan calls out the issue. It's hypocrisy. especially among the leadership. And you and I know what that is. Hypocrisy is pretending to be something that you're not. It's parading your virtues when you are not a virtuous person. It's purporting to love Jesus and then hating the people that Jesus loves. It's looking for Bible verses to basically buttress up your opinions and to avoid the harder issues that the scriptures call us to. So there's great wisdom in Paul's ancient advice to the church. Should we have leaders who are temperate, sensible, respectable, hospitable, and gentle? Of course. Our leaders are called to be consistent with the Christ they are proclaiming, and I hope that's not too much to ask. But just to be fair, there's no reason to restrict these expectations only to our leaders. We should expect good character and consistent behavior of one another. Others should respect these things of us, and all in the name of Christ. You know as well as I, if you've ever been in a leadership position, it's easy to put leaders on a pedestal, kind of a half step above the crowd. Really, all that does is to make them easier targets. It also sets them up for a greater fall. None of us have actually perfected the temperate, sensible, respectable, hospitable, gentle, and faithful life, which is why we need Christ to also pick us up when we fall, to help us to continually improve. In fact, we are forgiven. That is the essence of the gospel, but forgiveness never lets anybody off the hook. We are called to live lives of increasing goodness and generosity. So I wish Paul would have put that in the list as well. What he seems to give us is a bit of a scorecard for selecting leaders. And I know, at least as the church goes, there have been occasions when a nominating committee will ask someone to be a church officer, point to this chapter from chapter 3, and there are occasions when someone will look it over and say, you know, I'm really not that good. To that I reply, the life of faith is a school of character. It might surprise you if you step up when the need arises or the invitation comes. And I've come to believe after years of this that the first qualification of taking on a big job is feeling disqualified. How am I ever going to do this? I think that's where it always begins. And if we serve with our feet firmly on the ground, we'll not fly off in some vain fantasy. And sometimes we can actually grow into the leadership role once we take on leadership. There's a great new book by David Brooks that some of you have recommended to me called The Second Mountain, The Quest for a Moral Life. It follows up on the previous book he wrote called The Road to Character. And the irony, says Brooks, is that when he wrote the book about character, he really didn't know what character is. As the book on character soared to the top of the bestseller lists, his life was falling apart. A 27-year marriage imploded. He thought he had a lot of friends, but when trouble came, the friendships were actually an inch deep and the friends all evaporated. He now realized that his climb to become a nationally syndicated columnist and best-selling author had actually poisoned who he was. I was aloof, invincible, and uncommunicative, he said, especially in all the relationships that mattered. By his account, he then had to fake his way through a lot of interviews. He understood the importance of a strong personal character, but only from a distance. He had climbed the first mountain of personal success only to discover it isn't the mountain that really matters. What's far more important, he says, is the second mountain, the mountain of commitment to others, a deeper vocation of service, a faith consistent in something greater than your own ego, and the building of an interdependent community. I've just started the book, but I can already tell it's an important one. I want to talk with some of you about it if you read it too, so I commend it to you, The Second Mountain by David Brooks. And I can already hear in it the few echoes of the advice that Paul gives Timothy through all, and then to all of us. Don't be puffed up with conceit. Don't fall into disgrace and condemnation. Be well thought of by outsiders. And most of all, he says, serve well. For the good leader knows it's not about me. It's about the people I serve. So the question is always, how can my leadership, your leadership, be an act of service? So I think about these things and hope you will too. We're called by Christ to live honestly for the benefit of those around us. And if we're called to leadership, it is a blessing, but only if it becomes a blessing for those we serve.